From CAFE, welcome to CAFE Insider. I'm Preet Bharara.
And I'm Ann Milgram.
How are you? 21 days.
21 days. 21 days. I can't believe it. I have not yet gotten my absentee mail-in ballot in New York State, but I'm also thinking about voting in the election booth, so I'm okay. But I don't know if you saw this morning, the early voting opened in some states, and the lines were hours long.
Well, in certain counties in Georgia, especially. Yeah.
Yeah. Something like 10 million people have already voted, but everybody's got to make a plan to vote. You have to have a backup plan, and I hope everybody's, you know, geared up for the election.
So a lot happened in the last week, and we say this at least off air, if not on, every week, and that is by the time we get to Tuesday morning and taping, some of the stuff that seemed like gigantic news and was gigantic news has a little bit faded from memory. So among the things that happened last week was there was a vice presidential debate.
That's right.
Does anyone even remember that other than The Fly?
The Fly has taken on a life of its own, for sure. I don't know what you thought. Look, I thought it was a million times better than the presidential debate. I thought the moderator, and not to blame the moderator for everything, but I thought she tried to do a better job. She asked serious questions. But I did think, you know, the vice president did talk over time repeatedly. And I did just have this moment of thinking, like, we really need a parent of a young child to be the debate moderator. Because, you know, she was saying, thank you, Mr. Vice President, to get him to stop. But it's like, your child is doing something they shouldn't do. And if you say thank you, the takeaway is like, oh, you're welcome. I'll keep doing what I'm doing. And so I just had this moment of like,
guys don't get it.
Yeah, like why can nobody sort of just take a stand short of turning off a microphone? I think there's a lot that she could have done. So I was disappointed in that, but overall I thought it was substantive. You could really see the differences between the candidates. You know, look, I think there were a lot of things that I think the vice president just couldn't defend. I mean, you know, people talk a lot about the questions he didn't answer, like the peaceful transfer of power, which of course sticks out. I was also just taken by the fact that he cannot answer the question of why the United States, by comparison, is doing so much worse than all of the other developed nations in their response to COVID-19. And it was, I think, the first or second question of the debate, and it just stayed with me.
Why is the U.S. death toll as a percentage of our population higher than that of almost every other wealthy country?
Our nation has gone through a very challenging time this year. But I want the American people to know that from the very first day, President Donald Trump has put the health of America first.
What did you think of the debate?
So, yeah, I didn't want to stick a knife in my eye as badly as I did during the presidential debate. And mercifully, I think we're going to be spared the second debate, although I think Trump has sort of wimped out on that. What I found interesting about the debate was the reaction of people watching. And obviously, I thought Kamala did a great job, and I thought she was very good and very smart and very patient. If you liked Kamala, you thought she did great. If you liked Pence, you thought he did great. But people on the other side, I saw comments from people saying that Kamala Harris was terrible, horrible. There were lots of unprintable pejoratives used about her. And in the universe that I live in, I just don't see it. I can understand how you don't agree with her.
Yes,
I can understand. Yeah, I can understand how you disagree and maybe you don't like her policies. But objectively speaking, she did not crash and burn. So, you know, I don't know what's going on there. There's some sort of implicit bias. You know, Ben Shapiro posted something where he said she's losing it. She's getting crushed. I don't know. I didn't see that. Maybe I have my own bias.
I actually thought the opposite. Look, maybe I have my own biases too, but I thought she was far more, like, she was just making logical arguments, sort of, you know, answer one, answer two, answer three. Like, it felt much more methodical. You know, look, there were questions that they both didn't answer. And so I think some of the media criticism afterwards toward her was she didn't answer the court packing question. We'll talk about that in a minute. But overall, I thought she answered a lot more than the vice president did. She was very articulate. And I thought, you know, her tone was, if anything, I mean, I think a lot of people said this, there were a couple of opportunities where she could have just really gone after the vice president. And I personally believe she knew how to do it. She just chose not to do it, to sort of, you know, I don't know if take the high road is the right way to say it, but to just sort of, you know, leave a couple of things out there that I thought were just like sort of softballs that she could have hit out of the park. But anyway, I was stunned by that too. And I think I'll tell you one other thing I was stunned by, Preet. And I, you know, she and I did not overlap. I was one of, I think, like 6 or 7 female AGs in the country before she became the California AG. I've met her many times at this sort of annual women's AG dinner. You know, one of the things that is really clear is that the electorate has, and I think this is even true after 2016, like there is a bias against women. You know, there's a lot of polling that shows a man and a woman can say exactly the same thing and women are found to be less convincing and less credible by like 10 polling percentage points, by just this huge margin. And part of it is I think we've socialized kids and people to think of political leaders as men. But there was even the day before, there was a lot of this sort of, well, I hope she's not too aggressive thing. And it just made me angry, right? It's like, look, 210,000 people are dead. She's allowed to be angry and to call the administration incompetent. And this idea of like women have to act differently just felt to me played out a little bit in the comments we saw from some folks after.
So some people on the Pence side have suggested that Michael Pence like really speaks to suburban women, that he has some bond with suburban women that kind of like him in a special way. So at the moment, Anne, you're a suburban woman. Did you feel I have been on and off lately. Did you feel the fire? Did you feel the fire when Mike Pence spoke?
Well, let me just say one thing, that recently on a Saturday morning, I took our 6-year-old to soccer practice, socially distanced style. I had my lawn chair set up at the end of the field by myself. And I was like, wow, I am like, for the moment, a very suburban mom. So I feel I speak for all soccer moms. Look, one thing I'll tell you about Mike Pence, and you and I had sort of talked about this, he's a good debater. I mean, he has, you know, we've talked about the president lacking shame. The vice president also lacks shame. Like, he said some things that were just blatantly lies, and he said them with a straight face, and he said them artfully, and he spun them in his way. And, you know, I think people maybe see what they want to see. So,
yeah. Have you ever had a fly in your head for 2 minutes and not noticed?
No, but do you think it was, has anyone explained, he had a lot of hairspray on his hair. I don't know.
Oh, do you think the fly was trapped?
I don't know, but I did like the thing that went viral with the picture of Justice Ginsburg saying, I sent the fly.
moving on to the next debate, which was supposed to be Thursday. I got to tell you, I've watched every single presidential debate, I believe, except for one, going back like 20, 25 years.
Why'd you miss the one?
So I missed the first Obama-Romney debate in 2012, and I'm glad I did because, as everyone has said, and I've never gone back to watch it, Obama got his clock cleaned. I had an event. I had a speaking engagement that evening. And I'll never forget that I was a U.S. attorney at the time, you know, ending the first term, and I kept getting emails and texts from people telling me to work on my resume, because Obama was going to lose based on that debate. So I look forward to debates. I think you do learn something about the candidates.
Do you think they matter? Maybe not.
But the point I was going to make is I am not disappointed that there's no debate this Thursday. I kind of happy that we don't have to be subjected to that. Is that bad? Is it bad if you start to think there's it's good that there's no debate?
Well, but I think you would want there to be a debate if it was a real conversation where, you know, there were two people standing up there presenting different visions for our country. I think I always watch them. The Trump-Biden debate was completely different. And I think it's fair to say, like, I agree with the sort of pundits who said we all lost that night. Like, it was a bad night. And I think Biden by far was more credible. I thought he was far more appropriate and presidential. But, and look, I actually think if you look at some of the polling, there is a sense that with independents that a lot of people didn't like the president's attitude, his performance, his bullying, it was over the line. And I think people do judge a lot based on stuff like that as opposed to like what the policies are. And so in some ways, maybe it was important, but I for one, I'm good to miss this week's debate. I will also say this, though, it is cowardly of the president not to be willing to get on a Zoom town hall with the vice president for a debate. I mean, we send our kids, a lot of people are sending their kids to school on Zoom right now. And it's like, it's good enough for our kids, but not good enough for the president of the United States. Like it makes no sense to me other than just, he did badly. People have told him he did badly. There's a lot of pressure surrounding a debate and he doesn't want to do it.
I think the much, much better comparison, and with all due respect, is the fact that we do this podcast remotely. And if we can do this very, very important public service podcast
without seeing each other,
other in the studio, it'll be coming on 8 months. You can debate that way too. And by the way, you have a lot of people saying ahistorical things. I learned some things about history myself and try not to make blanket statements without knowing what the facts are. But you have some Trump people going on air. I think it's one of his sons said debate should be in person. Otherwise, it's not really a debate. That's been the way that we've done this for 200 years. The first televised presidential debate was Nixon Kennedy in 1960. They had three debates. The third debate, they were remote. One was on the East Coast, one was on the West Coast. So,
don't let history hold you back, Preet.
Yeah, I know. So something else going on as we speak, and maybe there'll be more developments as Tuesday rolls on. We're recording this, Ann and I, in the 10 a.m. hour on Tuesday, October 13th. Amy Coney Barrett has her confirmation hearing. So I presume you watched some of yesterday.
I did.
The opening statements. I was present for two Supreme Court confirmation hearings, Alito and Roberts, and had a hand in drafting the opening statement from my boss at the time, Senator Schumer. But I will say, 22 senators and then three more people to introduce the nominee, all droning on, giving their 5 minutes and some people going longer. I don't know how necessary that is. Did we learn anything yesterday?
I found it to be pretty painful. I think these are also really important processes. There was something I also wanted to ask you, which is that one of the main arguments that the Democrats were making yesterday is how unsafe it is to be holding a hearing in the Senate Judiciary Committee in person at this moment in time, which feels to me absolutely true. It also feels to me like I just wasn't sure if that's the main thing you should be spending your time on when you're there's a way in which the Democrats could have said, we're not going to show up. We don't think this is safe. I don't know. Was that effective to you? I was sort of sitting there feeling like there were almost two conversations going on. One or three. One is it fair that that the president has nominated and the Senate is going to ram through this nomination? Two, obviously her qualifications to be a justice. And three, the sort of coronavirus piece.
Well, and four, related to that, was healthcare. The one thing, talking to some people who are working on that on the Democratic side, one thing they said was they're all on message.
They are.
You and I have seen hearings where you have one senator saying one thing, another senator making a different point. Every single one came armed with a story or an anecdote about someone who would lose out if the ACA were thrown out. So they all had those stories. On the safety point, I thought it was a little odd that of the two Republican Senate Judiciary members who contracted coronavirus and publicly revealed that, Mike Lee and Tom Tillis, Mike Lee actually showed up in the hearing room and did not wear a mask when he spoke. I couldn't tell quite how far away other people were. Tom Tillis participated remotely. And then Ted Cruz, who was in the vicinity of people who were at that super spreader event, participated remotely too. So it was a weird thing. I'll say, in response to your question about what the Democrats might be able to do, I thought one of the most significant statements made in all of the speeches yesterday, Monday, was from Senator Amy Klobuchar, who said, almost as an aside, but it was a poignant moment, she's like, look, there's no clever ploy that we have to stop this nomination unless we persuade some Republicans to switch their votes. That to me seemed like a pretty gigantic concession.
Yeah. Look, a lot of it felt a little bit defeatist to me as well, right? A lot of it felt to me like this train has left the station. But, I guess I would argue a couple of things. First of all, you had Mitch McConnell on Fox News talking about how Obama left a lot of vacancies during the last 2 years of his term.
I was shocked that former President Obama left so many vacancies and didn't try to fill those positions.
I'll tell you why. I was in charge of the what we did the last 2 years of the Obama administration.
I will give you full credit for that. And by the way, take a bow. All right, that was a good line.
He was very clear in saying I was in control at the time, and I basically held those vacancies for the next president. And because I was betting on it being a Republican, it was. And I've now worked like crazy to fill those vacancies. And That's exactly what's happening here. So, I mean, I think it's really important to push continually the fundamental fairness question, because there is no fundamental fairness here, right? I mean, it just, it's stunning to me. It's, you know, 10 million people have now voted. It's really, it's unjust in a way. And look, if they'd seated Merrick Garland, I think we could argue where that line is, but because they didn't seat him, I think it's very clear that this is just about raw power. And it's almost like conceding that, like, the bully who takes half your lunch in the lunchroom, that you might as well give him the other half of your sandwich because he's bigger and he's stronger and he has the power to take it anyway, right? And it's like, there's something so, it's making me angry to watch it. And so, but I do think your overall analysis of Klobuchar is right. I also did think she was effective. And I think, you know, look, the healthcare thing is real. Like, the court's about to rule on healthcare. And so I think one of the topics of conversation has to be what impact this is going to have.
When you saw Mitch McConnell on Fox News, did you notice what he did as he was boasting that he blocked all those Obama judges?
The laughter. It sounded like one of Diego's cartoons.
And I will give you full credit for that. And by the way,
well, I'm going to use a verb that I don't think I've ever used in real life with anyone. I wouldn't say laugh. I think he chortled.
I was going to say cackled.
Have you ever used chortle?
A chortle.
Now that I say the word, is that a real word?
Yeah,
is that
an
actual English word? Chortle. I think that word was made for Mitch McConnell.
It was. It really is. It was such a boastful, proud moment of trampling on fairness, and it just struck me as like he had no humility about it. And actually, we should just say this. I think it was Sean Hannity basically said. He was talking about he was framing it as Obama's failure to get judges confirmed. And McConnell was like, no, Obama didn't fail. I won. And because I won, Obama failed. But like, don't give him the blame. Give me the credit. It was just so, yeah, it was stunning.
Yeah. Speaking of unfairness, there's even a more dramatic particular procedural unfairness that Chairman Lindsey Graham is going to work on the process. This is already a very accelerated process. Maybe not if you go back to the founding of the union, but in recent times in modern history, this is an incredibly fast confirmation process. They were doing the opening statements on what for many people is a holiday yesterday, Monday, October 12th. Ordinarily, you go through the confirmation hearing, 4 days of hearings, typically in the modern era. Then the following week on a Thursday, they have in the Senate Judiciary Committee what's known as a markup. People have time to review the transcript and reflect and consider their thoughts. And they then assemble in the Judiciary Committee hearing room, and they vote in what's called a markup. And if the Democrats want to delay the vote, they can. Republicans, if the shoe's on the other foot. But you wait until the hearing is over before you have a committee vote. Lindsey Graham has scheduled for this Thursday morning, before the hearings will even be over, an initial vote on Amy Coney Barrett. And, you know, maybe this is a little bit inside baseball. The people I know who are working on the Judiciary Committee, their heads are
exploding.
It's astonishing.
Because
you're having a vote before it's over.
Yeah, I mean, it undercuts, it makes it clear that this is all pretend. Again, you know, Graham has decided they have the votes, they're going to do it, and it doesn't matter. And it's basically saying, like, you're going to vote before you hear the outside folks weigh in on her nomination. It's bad. I mean, it's just a lack of respect for the process, for the Senate, for the Judiciary Committee. I'm not surprised by it. I don't know if, I know a lot of folks on the Hill just assumed it wouldn't happen like it's happening. But sort of sitting here as an outsider, it doesn't surprise me. Does it surprise you?
No, nothing surprises me anymore. Look, I mean, the president has been suggesting, why not do away with the hearings? Because the Democrats don't really seem to like them anyway, and go straight to the floor. I mean, that's one reason why, you know, Democrats are maybe showing up, because, you know, they want to get some message across, and they don't want to give Graham and McConnell an excuse to short circuit the process even more. I get it. It's a kind of a lose-lose proposition because the Republicans have the votes. So to borrow a phrase, you know, it is what it is.
Can I ask a question also, Preet? Like, one of the core, and we haven't seen the full hearings yet. I mean, it's just really getting started. But in her opening statement, Amy Coney Barrett told the Senate that
policy decisions and value judgments of government must be made by the political branches, elected by and accountable to the people. The public should not expect courts to do so, and courts should not try.
And I wonder what you think of that, because I agree generally, But it really depends on the level of the court. There are three levels of courts, federal courts in our country. There's the district court that tries cases. Then there's the appellate court that you can appeal issues of law that are decided during trials and by the trial court. Then there's the United States Supreme Court, and their job is to interpret the laws of the land. And in so doing, they frequently make policy. I mean, most other courts, I think you would argue trial courts should be following existing case law and laws. But appellate courts, often there are disputes over what laws mean, and the courts have to make decisions. And whether or not they set out to make policy or not, whether or not it's, you know, intentional, the Supreme Court in particular is often, they're just often pulled into these critically important debates where there is either insufficient precedent or there's an open question of law. And in making decisions, they always make policy, no? I mean, I don't know what your take is on it. I really jarred by it.
Yeah, I don't have the same reaction to it. I thought it was a pretty anodyne statement of judicial philosophy that many people would agree with, whether it is true in practice in every instance or not. I think it's the kind of statement that a Democratic appointed judge would make or a Republican appointed judge would make, that as a general matter, and then she said try not to make policy. She didn't say never make policy, which was an interesting caveat. That as a general matter, it is a principle that is at least stated, if not fully believed in, by both conservatives and progressives, that judges are there to decide cases and controversies, not to make policy, and not to have an agenda.
Well, it certainly, I guess it comes down to a question of intent, right? Maybe it comes down to a question of intent, but at the end of the day, the Supreme Court does make policy, and everyone should be clear. It's a little like Roberts. You know, he's that famous line of judges should be umpires, right? Calling the balls and strikes, right?
Yeah.
And yet the reality of being a judge is not that. And so particularly being a Supreme Court judge, right? Maybe we could argue being a trial court judge is just that. There's a lot of, you know, you're following existing laws and cases that the Supreme Court and circuit courts have handed down. But it just feels weird to me that we've established that the Supreme Court of the United States gets to decide what the law is. Right? It's the one court where that decision gets made. And that's why it's so important. And that's why President Trump is pushing to get Barrett through. And that's why McConnell is pushing to get her on the court. So look, you're right. Would any Democratic nominee have said it? Probably. But it's a sign in a way in which like the language around the nominations, it feels very like poll tested, and they're trying to say what they think the public wants to hear. And it's almost a charade of what the truth of this appointment is and will be. And I don't know. There was just something about it. Like, she's putting herself up as somebody who's like just a neutral arbiter of the law. Whereas, you know, she's of all the folks coming on the bench, as much as I think anyone we've seen has a very clear record, has spoken publicly about her view that precedent doesn't always hold and shouldn't be sacrosanct, and her feelings against Roe, against, you know, Roberts' ruling in the Affordable Care Act. So I think in some ways it's like she's done all that. And instead of fighting on that framing, she's decided to reframe it as like, look, I'm this neutral judge and arbiter. And it may be very effective.
I don't know what else you expect her to say.
Look, it may be very effective.
From my perspective, no Supreme Court justice or aspiring Supreme Court justice when nominated says anything other than that kind of dry, anodyne stuff. I remember back in 2005, I never forget, I gave a talk, I think at some law school, in the immediate aftermath of the Alito hearings. And people were talking about the proclamations that the nominee makes upon being put forward by the White House. And I'll never forget that Sam Alito made a statement, and it became the headline on page A1 of the Washington Post. And it was even worse than what you're describing with respect to Amy Coney Barrett. It was Justice Alito saying, I will keep an open mind. I will keep an open mind, of course. That's what every judge, justice, prosecutor, arbiter of anything, even down in small claims court, is supposed to do. But it was elevated. That statement of his own self-serving statement, doesn't mean a whole hell of a lot, was elevated to some kind of, you know, clarion call of principle when, as you point out, the proof is in the pudding. How are you going to decide particular cases, what your ideological bent is? Are you an originalist or are you not? Do you believe in a living constitution or do you not? So for me, it's like sometimes hearing politicians when they speak on cable news in favor of a candidate. It doesn't mean a whole hell of a lot because they have to check certain boxes, say certain things so as not to get into trouble. And some of what they say could have been said by both a Democratic nominee or a Republican nominee.
One other thing I've sort of noticed, and we don't talk a lot about politics, but I have been sort of watching this. There's been a lot of media coverage and a lot of focus on, in the first debate, Joe Biden, and then in the second, in the vice presidential debate, Kamala Harris, where neither of them would commit to not packing the Supreme Court, to not adding additional justices. And I think, you know, this is an example of very artful framing by the president and the Republicans in basically making this like a core piece of the argument. I think I said last week, like, it felt weird to me that they were even making a commitment when the answer in some ways should have been like, look, she's not on the court yet, and we don't think she should be approved if you do the right thing and you don't nominate a Supreme Court justice during an ongoing election, then we don't ever have to even get to that decision. And short of that, to basically say, like, look, we have no intention at this moment in time of doing anything, you know, we're not going to play the way that they play. But the problem with all of it, I've been thinking a lot about, is like, just this very artful framing, which is that the president has violated every rule of fairness and sort of every principle of fairness with this nomination, right? And has shown, like, again, the standard that McConnell had for Merrick Garland, like, is not being applied here, that you shouldn't confirm a justice in an election year. You should let the people decide. So in some ways, you know, instead of basically fighting about should the people decide or should Mitch McConnell decide, it's been twisted to be the president is violating norms and rules. It's now been twisted to this moment of, like, it's basically they're asking Joe Biden to play by the rules, right? Like, they're violating all these rules and they're asking Biden to play. There's just something about it that, like, again, I sort of think that the Republicans have been artful at framing this issue, but it's gotten a lot of traction. Joe Biden just said this morning he's not a fan of court packing. I sort of feel like he should have said it a while ago, but I wonder what your take is on it.
Here's the problem with all arguments. Many, many people are making their arguments not in good faith. There's a good faith reason to be concerned about expanding the court and violating a norm that's been in existence for 100-something years, although the court has been of different sizes before, and Congress has the absolute authority given to it by the Constitution to change the size of the court. It could be 7, it could be 8, it could be 9, it could be 11. But people aren't making those arguments in good faith. And what really angers me about the people who are now screaming and trying to put the fire out on their hair with respect to this idea of court expansion are some of the very same people, conservatives, Republicans, who not only prevented Merrick Garland from getting a vote or a hearing or even courtesy meetings with most senators, but openly talked about reducing the size of the court. The National Review published an article, at least one, maybe more, arguing in a serious way with a straight face, assuming that Hillary Clinton was going to win, that we allow the court to remain at 8, maybe even let it go to 7. You can't take people away from the court, right? That would violate the Constitution. But through a process of attrition, retirement or death, take the size of the court down. And if it's okay to change the size of the court in a negative direction, I don't know why all of a sudden it is the most extreme violation of world order to expand the court, to change the size of the court in a higher direction. So my problem with all of this is people are arguing in bad faith, people saying who have tolerated the breaking of every single norm you can think of, oh, well, now norms are important. They can't argue that it's unconstitutional. They can't argue that Congress doesn't have the power to change the size of the court. All they can argue is, wow, this is, you know, going to send the country to hell because of the violation of some norm. Now, there's a good faith basis to say those things, and I understand that. And Biden himself has said it before, and he seems to be saying it again, maybe because politically it's getting some traction on the Republican side. But, you know, I'd like to see, maybe this is too much to ask, I'd like to see people arguing in more good faith than they have been in recent times. Speaking of bad faith, should we talk about a couple of other things that you and I have been chattering about in the last week?
It's really the perfect segue.
Yeah. So I really hadn't been thinking about Rod Rosenstein, the former deputy attorney general, who appointed Bob Mueller as a special counsel, and before that was the U.S. attorney in Maryland. But then two things happened last week that I think deserve some of our attention. One was this New York Times report that details what looks to be in a draft of an inspector general report about child separations at the border. You remember, that's something that you and I talked a lot about on this show, and that a lot of people were upset about, and so upset and argued so vociferously against these child separations that lasted for a long time that it was one of the few things on which the Trump administration did an about-face, and one of the few things about which people sort of headed for the hills, not wanting to have responsibility for this terrible, terrible policy on the part of the United States. And it has been in the minds of a lot of Americans that it was really the doing of the Department of Homeland Security, and the bad guys and the culprits were Steve Miller in the White House, Donald Trump in the White House, and then people at DHS. And very quietly back then, I remember reading and hearing that the Inspector General at the Department of Justice was going to take an internal look and see what involvement and responsibility people at the Department of Justice had. And we haven't seen it yet, and it's subject to change, and it's just a New York Times report, and it's not gospel and released yet. But it paints a very ugly picture of how Jeff Sessions at the top and Rod Rosenstein, too, were really into this idea of childhood separations intentionally and deliberately for the purpose of deterring other migrants from coming over the border. And Rod Rosenstein, who has spent a career, as Jim Comey put it, being a survivor and trying to, you know, straddle lines so he can be on one side of an issue or the other side of an issue or escape blame, doing this tightrope walk, is at the center of the story. What did you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a really important conversation, and it's a really important story. And I do want to give a little bit of credit to the New York Times reporting that because they did review an 86-page draft report, the report cited interviews with more than 45 key officials, and then the Times also went out and talked to three government officials who had read it. So I think it's not speculation. I think people should know the Times is working off a draft. What it says in there, and you know, remember that at the heart of the policy was this idea that if you prosecute the parents who are unlawfully crossing into the United States and you separate them from their kids, that this would be a deterrent to stop people from coming. And again, it is sort of on its face just the cruelest, most awful policy in my view, to sort of intentionally try to target kids as a way to teach a lesson to their parents. And what this makes clear is that it's led by Jeff Sessions in many ways, because the normal practice is that people come into contact with immigration authorities and, you know, immigration generally has the authority to send them back. The people who have the authority to bring a case, to bring the prosecution, which would lead to the separation, is the United States Department of Justice. So the article says that Jeff Sessions, who was then the Attorney General, made it clear that Mr. Trump basically wanted this policy, this, quote, zero tolerance family separation policy. And there are notes from one of the participants on a call that Sessions said, quote, we need to take away children. This is missing from the quote, but it basically is saying, if parents, quote, care about kids, don't bring them in. And then goes on to talk about not giving amnesty to people with kids. Then Rod Rosenstein, who was the deputy AG, and remember that Rosenstein was a career prosecutor, the deputy AG generally runs the day-to-day of the office, he does a call with the U.S. attorneys telling the five prosecutors that it, quote, did not matter how young the children were. There had been prosecutors that had refused to prosecute two cases because the children were barely more than infants. And Rosenstein goes on to say that it doesn't matter how young the kids are. And so when he's asked, when he's interviewed for this Inspector General report, he goes on to basically argue that the removal of the kids was not DOJ's problem, that it was, quote, the equity, close quote, of the Department of Health and Human Services who had to take control of the children. And it is outrageous. It is so clearly to me an abuse of his authority as the deputy AG to say that there's no responsibility for what impact the prosecution would have when parents were entering the country with children or trying to enter the country with children that otherwise did not have other alternatives to care for them. And they weren't even trying to figure out if there were other options.
Couple of things. Then Rod Rosenstein, when he's asked about it, uses weasel words. I mean, I think his testimony, according to the New York Times, is something like, I never directed anyone to prosecute any particular person. And if any prosecutor, you know, brought a case against a particular person they didn't believe was correct, that's a violation of their oath. He made a general statement that you should not consider the age of the children. And there were also sentiments expressed between the higher-ups at the Department of Justice negatively about U.S. attorneys' offices that were not bringing these prosecutions. So it's kind of a twisted pretzel kind of logic to, on the one hand, have said things that would compel people to bring cases that would result in child separation, And on the other hand, say, I'm not responsible for it. And the other thing that's very clear from all that you're describing is, unlike some things where everyone was on the same side and wanted to proceed, there was a rebellion taking place within the department. There were line prosecutors and local United States attorney, at least one, who didn't think this was a good idea and were trying to fight back against it. So it, you have not only sort of a generalized policy that they can say was issued on a piece of paper. No, you had a controversy within the department. And Rod Rosenstein, in particular, and Jeff Sessions took a particular side in that controversy. And the side they took was one that is terrible and awful and that they will never live down and shouldn't try to weasel out of.
Yeah, I mean, look, weasel feels to me like the perfect word for Rosenstein. But in some ways, it's even worse than that, right? Because there's a way in which, you know, when he talked about the oath, like the person who didn't honor their oath to the United States and the United States Constitution was him. Right. I mean, it's sort of like he's putting it on other folks saying, you know, when you're faced with something you don't believe in, you shouldn't do it. Well, he did a lot of things and either he believed in them or he didn't. And he has continually tried to straddle this line in a way that's just not accurate. Right. I mean, it's just he has been and I want to talk about a few of the other things. But just to stay on this for one more minute, I think people also have to understand that the choice that Sessions and Rosenstein made here was a choice that was not about public safety. And so the idea was, you know, you're going to stop undocumented people from coming into the country by punishing their kids. The reality is that the draft report documents a number of things that were not known, including that, quote, Border Patrol officers missed serious felony cases because they were stretched too thin by the zero tolerance policy, requiring them to detain and prosecute all of the misdemeanor, these are the lowest level cases, illegal entry cases. So, you know, one Texas prosecutor warns the top DOJ officials in 2018 that, quote, sex offenders were released, close quote, as a result. And, you know, there's a lack of serving warrants in important cases by the Marshal Service because they just didn't have the capacity. So I think it's really important to know what choices they were making. And it feels incredibly political.
I just want to emphasize something that you said about how Rod Rosenstein violated his oath, and he did, both in spirit and in fact. So according to the report, you know, senior Justice Department officials viewed the welfare of the children as a responsibility of other agencies. And their duty is tracking the parents, right? Other people are supposed to do that. And here's what Ron Rosenstein says, quote, I just don't see that as a DOJ equity, end quote. What I learned when I was in the department is all of these things are part of a DOJ equity. If your job is to care about principles and fairness and justice, then you do care about those things. You can't just fob off that responsibility on some other agency. It's not how it works. And also to just put, you know, a fine point on the kinds of things that prosecutors were being asked to do and how they were repelled at it. You had one government prosecutor writing to his superiors in a note or in an email, quote, we have now heard of us taking breastfeeding defendant moms away from their infants. I did not believe this until I looked at the duty log, end quote. This is the kind of thing that Rod Rosenstein knew about, was aware of, didn't think was a DOJ equity, and then goes ahead and blames the prosecutors themselves for violating an oath. It's like the height of, to coin a phrase, the height of grossness to me.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think it's also really important to just note also that there was no plan in place. So you and I agree that prosecutors have to consider what's going to happen. You know, you don't just make an arrest and everything ends. You're making an arrest for a misdemeanor, a low-level offense, you're taking somebody's child away. There was absolutely no plan to get that child back. And so, you know, I sit on the board of a nonprofit that helps homeless youth. There are kids in Honduras who are in the custody of care of this nonprofit who have not yet been reunited with their families. And this is 2020. And so I think that anyone who doesn't understand the devastation of what this was and what this was intended to be is missing the point that they didn't care, right? And for Rosenstein to then double down and to blame the people who were saying like this shouldn't have been happening is just, it's like, it is the height of grossness. I want to say one other thing though, which this reminded me of. And I think Rosenstein, and I don't know what you think, he has gotten off way too easy. And he has gotten off way too easy because he is a card-carrying member of the Trump administration. He repeatedly compromised integrity and ethics, in my personal view, in order to benefit the president of the United States, who has shown shown that he does not follow the rule of law. And so the other thing that got me about Rosenstein's tweet was basically talking about the rule of law in our country is strong. And it's almost like he's trying to put himself in a position of like, I'm a hero of the rule of law, when it's the exact opposite. He's a coward, and he's trying now to hide behind the rule of law thing when he is one of the people who's undercut the rule of law in substantial ways. And we should talk about the Mueller report in a minute as well.
So the other thing that really kind of pissed me off, it doesn't happen often, was the combination of that report in the New York Times and Rod Rosenstein's role and the cold-hearted things he did and said. But also then, as you mentioned, I want to read it to folks, his delusional and self-righteous sanctimonious tweet. This is in the face of President Trump making these bizarre sort of statements about how Obama and Biden and everyone else should be prosecuted, even though there's no evidence supporting such a prosecution. Rod Rosenstein tweeted, quote, "The Department of Justice will ignore the president's threats against his political opponents, as it has in the past, because prosecutors who take an oath to support and defend the Constitution must uphold the rule of law," end quote, which is a fine, anodyne statement and high-minded statement, but coming out of his mouth without context of the current moment and without an acknowledgement of all the ways in which I think he has violated his oath, arguably, and has allowed other people to violate their oath, it really stuck in my craw. And what especially stuck in my craw is, for those of you who are not on Twitter, there's a new feature by which you can disable replies from your tweet and restrict them only to people who you follow. So Rod Rosenstein puts out this tweet, disables replies, which means literally no one can reply to him because he, in his sanctimony and self-righteousness, follows zero people, right? So, you know, he likes to put out his statement, oh, look at me, high-minded Rod Rosenstein, and we'll talk about ways that I think he has gotten off the hook on a variety of things for far too long, but also wants to relieve himself of the obligation to see what people have to say back to him. And I find that unacceptable and bad faith.
Yeah, I want to say two other things about Rod Rosenstein, and then of course we can move on, but really we could do an entire episode on him. The first is that it's really important to remember back in 2017 when he first came into office, you'll remember he's called to a meeting with President Trump. He is told at that meeting that Trump is going to fire Jim Comey. He's asked to write this memo, which basically, and he obviously, I'm sure the memo didn't come out of thin air. I'm sure he was complaining about Comey and saying Comey had violated the norms of the department by talking about the Hillary Clinton investigation, which a lot of people agree with. So he's asked to write this memo. He goes out, he writes this memo, he gives it to the president. The president walks out, and what shouldn't have been surprising to anyone, particularly Rosenstein, who knew that Comey was about to be fired, is that the president says, I'm firing Jim Comey because of what the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, said. And so he uses that memo that Rosenstein has written on what Comey did wrong with the Clinton investigation as a justification for it. So Rosenstein then, he threatens to quit. He goes out publicly. And it really all, in hindsight, now understanding that he left that meeting with the president, knowing that the president was going to fire Comey, he was a willing participant. He didn't stand up. He didn't say no. He went out and wrote a memo that anyone in their right mind should understand the president was going to be used. And he did it because he thought it would be hidden, because he didn't think it would see the light of day. And he apparently had no issues with it until it became public. And so this goes back to your view of Rod Rosenstein as the weasel in chief, because that's cowardly, right? It's like he's willing to violate whatever norms, whatever rules, whatever rule of law he has to violate. He just doesn't want to get caught. And that's where he starts to complain and walk it back. And he puts Mueller in as the special counsel. But it's always about him. It's always about his reputation. And when it mattered, and when he had to be standing up to the president, he did it.
I want to tell one more story before that. I should mention to folks, and as you know, over the weekend, in response to Rod Rosenstein's tweet, I tweeted a few things and foreshadowed this conversation, which was not going to go well for Rod Rosenstein. So I should put on the record, he reached out to me yesterday. He emailed me and asked me to call him. And I decided not to call him back because, you know what? He can defend himself in a tweet. I don't know if he was calling because he saw the tweets. I don't know if he was calling for some other reason. He and I are not friends, so I don't think he was calling to get a Zoom drink. But I should just leave here that he did reach out to say something. I don't know what. He can respond afterwards.
It would be really awkward if he was trying to get you for a Zoom drink. I'm just picturing what that would go like. But anyway, sorry.
I have other folks that are a higher priority for Zoom drinks than Mr. Rosenstein. But here's a story that is overlooked, and I think sort of encapsulates a lot of the problems with Rod and how he tries to have it both ways. The opening anecdote in Jeff Toobin's latest book called True Crimes and Misdemeanors is interesting to me. And this is publicly known, but I think it just doesn't get the attention it deserves. On May 16th, right, on the eve of Rosenstein appointing Mueller, and I'll say, look, that was a good move appointing Mueller, but I have a view as to why he did that. I think it was more about Rod than about the country and about the Department of Justice and about finding out the truth. I think Rod was under attack and he was being maligned by all sides, people who had supported him in the past because of his role in the firing of Jim Comey. And he thought, what is the way to make it right for me? And sometimes the things that are right for you align with what's right for the country. And I think in this case, it did. But make no mistake about what his motivations overall were, in my mind. He wanted to make things right about himself. And so he did the nuclear option and he appointed Bob Mueller. But before that happened, as Jeff Toobin points out in his book, there was a meeting at the White House attended by Rod Rosenstein. And actually, the meeting was set up by Rod Rosenstein, at which the president was going to hear from Bob Mueller, who was at that point a private citizen in private practice. And the purpose of the meeting was to get a little guidance and advice from Bob Mueller about who the next FBI director should be. Literally, Rosenstein had reached out and brought Mueller to the White House, the Oval Office, in fact, to have this meeting, right? Rosenstein's there, the president's there. That's what the purpose of the meeting is. After Bob Mueller gets appointed as a special counsel, Donald Trump repeatedly, again and again and again, said to the public, partly in an effort to denigrate Mueller and also maybe to get him to recuse himself on an alleged conflict, said that Bob Mueller had come to the White House to beg for his old job back, that he wanted to be the FBI director, which, by the way, I think was a violation of law because he had already served the full term that had been extended by Congress. Again and again and again, the president blatantly lies to the public in an effort to, you know, cast aspersions on the special counsel. What did Rod Rosenstein do? To my knowledge, and maybe he can correct it, and maybe I'm wrong, and I'll concede it if I'm wrong, he never corrected the record. He never said that's not true. And look, I should say that Rod Rosenstein addressed for like a fleeting moment this particular Mueller issue on the Words Matter podcast a few months ago. But to my mind, it was a day late and a dollar short. I think he told Jeff Toobin in the book it was not true. But here's an example of Rod Rosenstein, on the one hand, touting the integrity of Bob Mueller, appointing Bob Mueller. In some ways, he's gotten away with a lot of things because he was seen by Democrats as someone protecting the Mueller investigation. But here's a small point on which the president is lying again and again and again about Mueller begging for his job back, knows it's not true, keeps his mouth shut.
And using it to undercut the investigation, right? To be clear, yeah, it undercut was very the investigation. Clear, yes, why the president was doing it.
But how do you explain that?
Cowardice.
How do you explain?
Cowardice and a lack of principle. I mean, I think also we knew this, and we talked about this a little bit when Barr did the summary of the Mueller report, which, remember, Robert Mueller came out and wrote a letter saying this is not an accurate summary of the report. And, you know, Rosenstein stood right by Barr, and they put in the letter that they both agreed that the obstruction part was not prosecutable as obstruction. And they twisted and I think deeply misrepresented the work of Robert Mueller. And so I think, you know, look, Rosenstein, he's a survivor. He cast his lot. He was always looking at where the wind was blowing, and he just didn't want people to see who he really was. So he kept his head down when it suited him. And I think that sort of story tells you a lot of what you need to know about him. I also think that there's an important way in which I want to sort of say two other things. I want to remind folks that for the Time 100 people of the year in 2019, and look, that's a great list of people who are prominent in our society, and you've been on it, I think, right? Weren't you on it? Yes.
I was.
Yes. Rosenstein is writing, whenever somebody's on it, they ask a prominent person to write a blurb. Rosenstein writes one for Bill Barr, and he basically says, you know, about Bill Barr, he knows the history, he understands the issues, he respects the employees, and he will defend the principles. With Bill Barr at the helm, the rule of law is secure. And, you know, it's just, it's like an extraordinary thing to me. But I think we should all be clear that he really cast his lot in with Barr and with the president. The last thing I'll say, and this goes back to him calling you, and, you know, you and I generally, we don't go after people. We don't talk badly. We it's nothing is personal. This, of course, is also not personal. But I do want to make a note about sort of like the legal elite and how people can hide behind these sort of like norms and unofficial sort of groups of people who have, you know, he's a former U.S. attorney. He's been a senior Department of Justice official. There's a certain level of deference, I think I should say, that he has exploited to basically, you know, to continue on without having to answer for how he undercut the Mueller investigation, for how he misrepresented its findings. For, and I agree with you. Look, he appointed Mueller. He also did a lot to basically make sure that that was never going to be effective, that it was never going to hurt the president. He is now a lawyer in private practice at King and Spalding, a very prominent law firm. He was recently elected to the board of the American Law Institute, of which I am also a member. And it's like I think you and I both have had this moment in the past week of saying, like, why is he not held to account for the actions that he has taken that have been contrary to integrity, to the rule of law, to, I would sort of argue, to the well-being of the American public? And so, you know, if anyone's violated his oath, I think it's him. And I don't say that lightly, but I think it's really serious. And I think that we have to be willing as lawyers to call out people in our midst who are doing what he's doing, which is trying to shade the truth so that he can survive yet another period of time and go on and further his career. And I just, you know, it was too much for me when I saw the Twitter stuff as well.
Yeah, there's one thing we can thank Rod Rosenstein for. I don't know that you're going to guess what I'm about to say. But back when he resigned, he submitted a letter to the president, which I think at the end of one of our shows, you read on air. And among other things, in his thanks to the president, he wrote the following line, quote, "As I submit my resignation effective on May 11, I am grateful to you for the opportunity to serve, for the courtesy and humor you often display in our personal conversations." And you began cracking up.
I couldn't do
as
it.
You read
it was
that.
Like the pina colada song.
And then I started laughing.
Yeah. I like long walks on the beach, pina coladas at sunset.
Getting caught in the rain. If you like pina coladas, get caught in the rain. But the reason I mention it is that was how was born a sort of regular feature of the Cafe Insider podcast, where you will try to get through reading something without laughing.
You know, we do. You're right. It's fair.
Laughing challenge.
And we owe a debt of gratitude.
That was spawned by Rod Rosenstein. So he did do one public service.
Yes. Fair enough.
So, and we're running out of time, and it's such a, you know, newsy week that we haven't even gotten to what was gigantic news last week, I think last Thursday, where both state and federal charges were brought against a total of 13 people who were alleged to have conspired to kidnap the governor, the sitting governor of Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer. They were charged with, under Michigan law, some of them were charged with material support of domestic terrorism, and the others were charged with conspiracy to kidnap. This comes, obviously, in the face of a lot of heated rhetoric by the President of the United States. Remember when he was tweeting things like, "Liberate Michigan"? And it raises a lot of questions about who is being encouraged to do what kinds of things. It was odd in the wake of the charges being brought, you know, by, you know, this administration's own Justice Department, we must say, that the president still gets into a war of words with the person who was in harm's way and at risk of, you know, severe violence. So I don't sort of get it. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on, you know, not just the case, but on the state of rhetoric in this country and violence.
Yeah, I mean, just to take a moment on the case, I think a lot of people haven't followed the facts that closely, but it's an extraordinary thing. I mean, 6 people charged by the federal government, 7 people charged by the state, all of them with this plot to kidnap or potentially kill the governor of the state of Michigan. And it's really terrifying. I mean, they belong to or were associated with a group of right-wing militia members, essentially, you know, espousing far-right extremist views. And it really is, you know, a few things really come to mind that I think are worth noting. The first is that this isn't a theoretical plot, and people should understand that, you know, law enforcement follows plots like this for a long time. they got to a point where there were multiple co-conspirators who met to put together money for explosives and to exchange tactical gear. And so, you know, this is not some hypothetical somebody espousing a view and saying, you know, that they want to target somebody. These are really concrete. And there are a series of concrete actions that these folks have taken to further this goal. And so it is really terrifying. And it's terrifying not just because of what they believe, that is hate-fueled, you know, sort of militia, right-wing sort of types of rhetoric, but also that they were taking so many actions and that they were going out to basically pull together money to make explosives. They'd also cased her vacation home. They'd looked at a bridge that was nearby for a place where they could sort of station themselves. And they had what I would describe as a pretty intricate plot. So that's the first piece for people to understand just how serious it is. The second piece is that we have to be honest that as we have watched over the past, you know, 3+ years now, that the sort of right-wing extremists, the right-wing militias, the folks who are, you know, amassing arms and weapons and are targeting people whose views they do not agree with have become more powerful and more frequently sort of outspoken in our public life. And we've seen this, we've seen folks show up at some of the peaceful protests in response to Black Lives Matter. We've seen this increasing trend, and I think we have to be very honest about how deep this goes in society and how important it is to root it out and to not allow this type of hate, and particularly this type of hate-filled violent extremism that can have just horrific consequences to go on. And so the president, you know, immediately, you know, was on the attack against the governor. She also basically said, I think very clearly, like, look, the president's rhetoric is leading people down this road. The president has refused to take responsibility for that. But look, I think language matters. I also noted, and I don't know what you think of this, but Bill Barr, you know, he's got his finger in these very small, and I'm not in any way belittling the importance of election fraud, but he's out there giving public statements talking about state election fraud cases, misrepresenting them. We talked about, you know, the case from Texas recently where he had the facts wrong. He basically said that there were, like, I think thousands of fraudulent ballots. It turned out not to be the case. It was a very small state matter. It wasn't even a federal matter. And he makes no statements on this, right?
Yeah. So I was wondering if that's because he's not been coming in because of COVID and his exposure to COVID. But it is remarkable that on a case this significant, the press conference was done by the Assistant Attorney General of the National Security Division. I'm not aware of a comment by him. Maybe he has a quote in the press release. I'm not sure. But this is the kind of thing that historically an attorney general would rightly be, you know, touting as a significant victory for law and order and rule of law, which are phrases that Bill Barr and the president use all the time. Why not in this case? Could it be? And again, maybe it's not for this reason, but given the context and the track record, one has to wonder, could it be because it doesn't fit a certain narrative of, you know, all violence being perpetrated by Antifa and people on the left?
Yeah.
When you have violence being threatened by people on the right, he seems not to be as thrilled about
it. Yeah. I mean, look, it's worth noting law and order is about, you know, pursuing any facts that under the law lead to crimes that are serious matters, and that requires that cases like this be prosecuted. It doesn't seem like the U.S. attorney had a moment's hesitation or the state AG in bringing these charges. And the idea that he wouldn't stand out, you know, in favor of the rule of law and order by basically saying, like, look, if you plot to assassinate political leaders, which is essentially what this is, like, you know, you're going to be captured, you're going to be caught, and fully prosecuted under the full extent of the law. And so this idea of, like, law and order is only when, like, he's only willing to talk about law and order when it benefits the Republican side. Again, it's really troubling to me. And I also, look, I think we should be honest and just be grateful, like, there's some really good law enforcement work at the state and federal level. The local police officers and law enforcement officials and the FBI have done a really good job. And these are complicated cases often to make, and they've done a great job. So I think, you know, that should give people some solace. What really caused me to pause is, like, this is a national case. This is super important. And the attorney general is not willing to sort of go out and speak on it. A lot of people might not realize what a statement that is, but it's a huge statement.
Indeed, that is true. How come I can see you now?
Oh, wait, hold on. I'm having a Zoom problem. Come on. Come on. 3, 2, 1. Happy birthday to you.
I'm like, what is going on?
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear me. Happy birthday to you. I think we're better at our jobs than we are at singing.
That was well. I'm very touched and thrilled at the birthday wishes.
We thought we'd be done with a lot more by the time we.
You didn't rehearse, did you?
We didn't rehearse. We got to keep it spontaneous.
No, because suddenly I'm looking at the screen and I see my brother, and I'm like,
"Oh, no.
why is my brother popping in to our taping? This is not a good sign for my future at the company."
It's quality assurance.
Right. Happy birthday, bro.
Thanks, man. Thanks,
happy
guys.
Happy birthday, Preet.
Happy birthday.
29.
Thanks, guys.
So a lot more coming up in the coming week. The continuation of the Amy Coney Barrett hearings, and probably lots of things that we're not expecting will come to pass in the next week, too. Make sure you vote.
Thanks, Preet. Please send your questions or comments to letters@cafe.com.
That's it for this week's Insider Podcast. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Anne Milgram. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior producer is Adam Waller. The senior audio producer is David Tatasciore. And the Cafe team is Matthew Billy, Nat Wiener, Sam Ozer-Staten, David Kurlander, Noah Azulai, Jake Kaplan, Calvin Lord, Jeff Eisenman, Chris Boylan, Sean Walsh, and Margot Malley. Our music is by Andrew Dost. Thank you for being a part of the Cafe Insider community.